Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
I'm your host, Ashley Chance, and in this episode, Britta Peterson and I talk with Renee Tamala, a senior regional rep in North Dakota, about how childhood experiences led her to a career in conservation, how Women on the Wing chapters began, and what it's like to have a dog that loves porcupines a little bit too much. Women make up 36% of the Habitat Organization's workforce and are having a major impact on conservation across the country. In this special Women on the Wing series, we're going to explore their professional journeys, do deep dives into their areas of expertise, and talk about what conservation means to them. Britta, what is new with you?
Ashley, I am just coming off my eclipse high from earlier this week. And so I know it's not necessarily habitat related, but it's natural world related, and it was fantastic. So that is feeling good.
Okay, I actually want to hear all about this because I experienced the eclipse in Middle Tennessee, and I'm going to be honest, my husband was like walking out the door right as it started happening. I was like, what's going on? I looked outside, he's like, oh, I think it's the eclipse. And you know, it was partial. I don't know the path of totality, whatever. But I was like, are you sure you want to leave right now? Because it gave me problems. Like, it did not feel good to see the sky going dark. And I was like, even though I know why this is happening, he's like, you'll be fine, and left. So what was your experience?
So it was just one of those things that if you aren't in totality, it's really hard to explain, actually, because it's this thing, right, that it's hard to put into words. And I saw the one in 2017 in Oregon, and it was about 2 minutes of totality, and it was not long enough. And so this one was 4 minutes long, and it was still not long enough. And so it's just, I don't know, it makes you feel like a tiny little speck and puts a lot of things in perspective because you feel tiny. But it was actually really interesting to observe just different critters and how everything changes and how sensitive especially our critters are to light levels. So we actually ended up in a cemetery in Arkansas that was adjacent a wildlife area, and so we had like a great, everything worked out perfect to have a great great conditions. But then we had a lot of birds singing in the wildlife area, so it was fun to just be right there. But as soon as it started getting dark, those birds stopped, the crickets came on. And then after we had totality, then, the birds just went bananas. Like, it was morning. I mean, so it was totally melodic singing. I mean, just really, really vibrant noise, just like morning, way different than, you know, 5 minutes before when they were just doing their like midday chatting. So just little stuff like that was super cool. And then just, you know, having the world go dark is real weird, but awesome. So
that is so cool. Okay, so if I ever get the opportunity, I'm going to take advantage of experiencing the path of
totality. 2044 is the next one in the U.S., but I was like, I can't wait that long. So Iceland 2026, here I come.
Gosh, I want to go. Iceland's been on my list for a while. Yes. I had a layover there once, but anyway, okay, let's rein it in. That was good. Renee is here with us, and we're so excited to learn about her background and what she specializes in for her work. Renee, to kick us off, can you tell us about what's in your freezer?
I have a very full new stand-up freezer filled with mule deer. A mule deer buck that I took in November, my first, which prompted the purchase of a new freezer. So I've got everything from pheasant and waterfowl and turkey to now an excess of mule deer, which I'm really happily chipping my way through.
Nice. What's your favorite thing to make with mule deer? I've not ever had any, I don't think. So that's awesome.
It's hard to beat backstraps, but one of my new recipes that Erica Diven, also with PF, introduced me to is the shank recipe. And so taking the shank and braising that, boiling it down, and getting all of that tallow and connective tissue and all of that good stuff into a meal with mashed potatoes or noodles, whatever you want to do. And it's, if you haven't tried it, you really have to. It's phenomenal.
I cannot sing the praises of Shanks enough. We've been experimenting with other cuts as well over the years, but I think anytime it comes to venison of any variety, and honestly, other animals too, turkeys in particular, shanks, leg meat, oh my gosh, it's so good.
It is, and I'm very excited to experiment with different cuts as well, because I grew up in like a sausage venison family where everything that wasn't a backstrap went into sausage and or maybe some chunks of stew meat. But now I'm actually getting to have a little creative freedom on those cuts, and it's really enjoyable and really fun.
Britta, what's your most adventurous thing that you eat from a deer?
I'm so boring.
You grew up in a sausage family,
no,
too?
No, I actually didn't. My dad is really pretty good about, he keeps everything clean and it's really good. So I guess, I mean, you just can't beat, like, the chops, you know, this, that, with a little bit of, like, on the grill with some roasted potatoes or whatever. I mean, it's so hard to beat that. But definitely with, like, turkey and pheasant legs and stuff, I've definitely gotten more to like slow cook, put them in the slow cooker, and man, what a way to eat those things too. So that's been a newer thing for me, is to really make sure. Before it would just be like gnawing on the legs after you eat them, but I think slow cooker is the better way to go.
100%. Yes. So when I kill a deer, I get all the offal, like all of it, pretty much. I cut the tongue out, liver, heart. I've tried to get caul fat, but I need to get like a little tiny tarp because it always ends up getting leaves or grass, whatever. It doesn't work out. And kidneys. I don't know if I said kidneys, but I take those too. And when my husband goes hunting, I'm like, remember, get the liver, get the kidneys. He's like, yeah. And like, he might come home with one or two of them, but he always brings the tongue because tongue tacos, man. They're amazing. Super good.
You might inspire me, Ashley.
It's very fatty, and then you like crisp it at the end, and so it's just like crunchy. Oh, it's super good. He's like, no. That's all right. It can take a while to experiment with some, get comfortable with experimenting with some of those things. But, all right. Well, thank you for sharing what's in your freezer, Renee. That's always fun. And congrats on the new purchase. Can you tell us what brought you to Pheasants Forever? I mean, like, just in general, how did you land here?
Definitely. I went to the University of Minnesota Crookston for wildlife management, natural resources management. I do joke that I would love to go back through my degree because it was so fun. So I don't think I'm actually joking when I say that, but it was a really small community and so hands-on. I loved all of the courses. I'm sad to report I didn't necessarily hold any cool jobs before I came on with PF, but the internship that I did at a soil and water conservation district in northwest Minnesota through the Conservation Corps was super valuable. I did hydrology testing, crop residue surveys, equip site checks, bluebird nest box monitoring, outreach, basically more than you think that you could fit into a summer. So it was so valuable. And I was fresh out of college when I saw a job posting from PF for a women's outreach coordinator. And it was like, whoa, I can't believe that's a thing. It's truly a combination of what an outdoorsman who grew up on a farm wants to do without even knowing that it exists. I didn't get the job, but a now good friend of mine did, and I was recommended to the regional rep job that was opening up. And now today I've been on with PF for nearly 7 years and am the senior field representative for North Dakota and Northeast Montana, as you said.
So, okay, I just want to rewind for a second. The internship that you described, did you call it an internship?
Yeah.
It's in that vein, yeah. I had something similar at a juncture in my career, and I feel like those summer experiences are just jam-packed with, like, you say you want to go back and do your degree. I want to be an intern for another summer. That would be awesome. Anyway, so you went to school in Minnesota. Is that also where you grew up?
It is, yep. Minnesota. My folks now are up near Duluth, actually, so up in the timber. And I've been in Bismarck, North Dakota for, I think, 7-8 years now. Time flies when you're having fun.
Did you always have an interest in the outdoors, Renee?
I did. I am a self-professed nature nerd, so I grew up outside just barefoot and most likely in a tree somewhere. So I've just always felt most myself when I'm outside, and I got to follow my dad through wetlands and woods, and he took me anywhere that I wanted to go and tag along with him. So really just immersed in the outdoors and really fostered my love, which was the trajectory of my life, which is how I'm where I am today.
Renee, when you talk about being with your dad in the outdoors, is that how you got started hunting?
It is. I grew up in his hand-me-downs a lot of times, so clothes that were far too big for me, and he was always rolling my sleeves up or pulling my hair back, and usually soaking wet in a canoe in some creek filled with rice somewhere in Minnesota, hanging on to a dog. And he'd, before I could actually hunt myself, he would bring birds home and let me take part by helping clean. So I could take the hearts out of ducks and do different things like that. He'd give me little tasks to do to be a part of it before I could be out there with him. And then as soon as I could, we went over 20 years without missing a duck opener together, and he's just, yeah, I have him to thank for all of my outdoor hobbies and pursuits, which keeps me very busy.
I feel like some of those early, like, before hunting age memories are some of my favorites as well. I remember falling in the swamp, getting all wet, but like having a great day when I was 10 or something, you know, like just kind of what you're saying, even that before the 10 or 12, whenever you could start hunting, those stick with you just as much as a hunting trip, I think.
Absolutely, they do. I remember sleeping at the base of his tree stand when we'd go deer hunting, and having a flock of turkeys come up while I was sleeping, and he watched them get all the way up to me, and I woke up to them, and he got a good kick out of that. But those really stay with you forever. You're spot on there.
That's an amazing story, and what an amazing dad to just let that play out before you had a smartphone to videotape it. I'm assuming. Oh, that's awesome. So I'm going to add my own memory that came up when, Britta, you were talking about that. My dad, when I was growing up, my dad would go deer hunt on the farm where he grew up, like 45 minutes or so from our house with uncles, etc. And when they would get a deer, or when it was over, like the weekend was over, we would go down. This is when I was pretty little, and they would, you know, I don't know what they did. The deer were hung up. They maybe took pictures, drank beer. But I can remember getting a stick and like poking the deer's eye and bending its foot and just being like so amazed at being so close to this animal and being able to experience it in that like super tactile way, which probably sounds morbid, but was just like from a biology perspective, you know, I didn't have that language at that time, but it was just the birth of me today, I guess, in a lot of ways, kind of like what you were saying, Renee.
It's really cool to see nature of the wildlife variety that up close. And man, I don't, obviously not every kid is going to be up for that. So you kind of take it however they, whichever route they want to go, but it is really important. And
actually, if we can pivot, I am curious. So, okay, before starting in this role, I did not know that regional reps existed. I'd never heard of that before. I never worked really for an organization that had the chapter structure like we do. And then when it was explained to me, I was like, oh, that, yeah, we definitely need those people. Critical link in the chain. So can you tell us what regional representatives do?
This is likely the hardest position to put into a nutshell, so I will try. To put it simply, my role sits in between our local grassroots chapters and our organization, and then within our field rep team across the country, and is connected to probably every single department within the organization. So we help chapters fundraise effectively and then turn those dollars into mission delivery, assisting with habitat outreach projects, our three things like learn to hunts and learn to shoots, and growing women on the wing, habitat programs, volunteer recruitment, supporting national programs like our advocacy and our education and outreach at the national level. So basically, I'd say that we're the generalists of the organization because we dabble in almost everything.
That's a lot, man. I know I very much appreciate our chapter and chapter model that we have with the organization, but that liaison between, you know, our organization, the biologist, and our chapters is critical. So it's a big time job for sure.
It is, and it's fun. It's so rewarding. There's never a typical day on the job, which is one thing that's pretty cool about it. One night, I'm emceeing a banquet, and the next day, I'm teaching elementary school kids about monarchs and habitat while we're planting a pollinator plot. The next, I'm planning a hands-on habitat workday or designing a habitat program for a chapter. There's never a dull moment. There's always something to do, and there's a lot of variety.
That's so cool. Yeah, it's kind of like you're the shepherd of chapters in a way, you know. And I know from experience, I get to interact with chapter members, chapter leadership a little bit just by virtue of them like providing some funding for particular events that chapters can do. But I'm sure a lot of those relationships that you form are longstanding and super rewarding. And I mean, you get to kind of be embedded in a community that spans an entire state and beyond.
Yes, it's really incredible. I feel very privileged, very fortunate to be able to do what I do. And across North Dakota and Northeast Montana, I have what I consider family in all of these communities and get to see the hard work that they pour into the mission delivery of PF and QF. And it's just really, it's humbling and it's amazing to be a part of. So I have a really big family at this point.
It sounds cool too. I mean, in that big area that you cover, you probably have a different habitat types to kind of work on different things with the different chapters. So that I can imagine keeps it really thrilling to kind of have options to work in all of those areas.
There is a variety, that is for sure. And there's also through just the way that our chapter model is structured and letting the passions of each chapter and each volunteer committee that makes up the chapter come to light. So if they want to focus on habitat or access or outreach, you get to see that across the state. And it's very incredible.
So we have two, correct me if I'm wrong, I know there's at least two. We have two types of chapters, what we call traditional chapters, and then we have women on the wing chapters. And Renee, I know you're like the resident expert on Women on the Wing chapters. You said that you've been in this role now for 7 years, I believe. Can you take us back to the early days in North Dakota and kind of the beginning of Women on the Wing?
Love to. We'd be rewinding to 2017 about, which was when I came on with the organization, really probably 2018, when all of the PF staff in North Dakota were women. There were five of us, and a majority of us were biologists. And so given that we were all female, we were perfectly poised to take on women's targeted outreach efforts. And it seemed to be right around the time, don't quote me on this, but right around the time that people were realizing the rising tide of female hunters and that rising demographic. We held an inaugural event to get us started, Women, Wine, and Wild Game. So combining as many W's in a title as we possibly could.
Right, get them in there.
And We held it on a Wednesday to boot, so it was a lot of W's. But basically, to gauge interest and kickstart our women's targeted efforts. And ladies came out of the woodwork. The room was buzzing with this vibrant energy that I had never seen before. It was so inspiring and so connecting. I'll never forget what that room felt like. And after that, we held a women's wing shooting clinic series, which was a progressive shooting series. And we saw a crazy response for that as well. And it really just took off like fire across the organization and across other states. And ultimately, a national initiative, Women on the Wing, was the rising phoenix, so to say, that came out of it. And I just hosted a Women, Wine, and Wild game last week, and the Wing Shooting Clinic series is on its sixth year here in Bismarck, so those efforts are pretty tried and true and still going really strong.
That's awesome. Do you, when those ladies first came with that event, do you think it was a lot of women hunters, or was it kind of just all across the boards as far as kind of who attended? I know, I'm just curious in asking just because I know some of our events have been more habitat focused and we see a ton of response too. So I was just curious if you felt like it was just a bunch of, you know, lady hunters, or if it was a mix.
It was truly a mix, which was really refreshing. And one of the big reasons that I love Women on the Wing is because it brings all of those narratives that are so unique and special to individuals to a room, to the table, to the community. And we had women that just like to go to state parks and national parks. We had foragers. We had, maybe you could say, not even a non-hunter, but maybe somewhat just not even someone who understood what hunting was or why you would do it. We had anglers. We had landowners. We had a truly a wide array of ladies.
They were just trying to find their space.
Amazing. Okay, so I know just in the time since I began, which I don't, that's my benchmark for everything. Sorry, listeners. We're going on 9 months now. Since I began, I feel like there's been an explosion in Women on the Wing chapters that have formed across the country. Can you kind of give us the trajectory of that and where we're at today?
Yes, it has really, again, caught like fire. So there are 13 chapters as it sits today, which is so damn cool. I had to write down the locations because I would not remember them all. So for full-fledged Women on the Wing chapters, we have them in North Dakota, Texas, Minnesota, Michigan, North Carolina, Washington, Georgia, Wisconsin, Arizona, South Dakota, and Ohio. Which is so cool.
That's awesome.
That is so cool. That is so cool. Okay, I want to say that's coast to coast. Maybe close enough. If not, I'm trying to remember all the states you listed. But hopefully we can put that in the show notes too. What does it take to start, I mean, I guess to start a chapter, but to start a Women on the Wing chapter, if there's people listening that are like, this seems like something I'd be interested in doing.
Our regional rep team helps coordinate any interested ladies that may want to spearhead a chapter or connect you to an existing one. And I do want to say that there is ample opportunity within traditional chapters for Women on the Wing efforts. And so much of that is already taking place across the country, whether that's through a Women on the Wing chair or even a subcommittee, if you would, within a traditional chapter. But I've seen time and time again what happens when you create this space and how profound of an impact it can have. And so if you have a desire to help grow a community of outdoors women, create the opportunities for like-minded women to connect, really be a part of the unique, inspiring, dynamic energy that is Women on the Wing, then I'd absolutely encourage you to consider starting one if there is not a chapter near you. And myself, my fellow reps across the country are here to help every step of the way. The resources exist, and I can guarantee you that you'll be pleasantly surprised at the response it'll have.
Do you have a, I mean, are there different, I'm assuming there's different motivations for
each of those chapters, like we were talking about, as far as, you know, everyone has different interests, but do you have, like, is there some chapters that are more focused on, like, the hunting aspect, and some are, you know, on habitat, or is it kind of all a mix too?
It seems to be primarily a mix. However, we can engage women in conservation, help them become more dynamic conservationists, learn the ropes of upland hunting, or even turkey hunting, or dove hunting, fishing. Our Washington Women on the Wing chapter holds cool events like Unstuck Your Truck and teaches you how to do just that. Our Ladybirds chapter here in Bismarck holds a host of events, from Hike for Habitats, Women, Wine, and Wild Game, the Wing Shooting Clinic series. We go cross-country skiing together. We do Paint Your Pets. We do a lot of the fun social events in addition to habitat work days. We do a women's pheasant hunt each fall. And so typically I think I see most often that it serves a broad community of outdoors women and whatever they want to see. And truly it's however that chapter is comprised too. Because women are sharing what passions they already have and what talents they already have. And so if someone is really good at foraging and making wine out of a native berry here, then they teach that. And we go out to their place and run through what it takes to forage and make that wine. So it's pretty darn cool to see all of the passions that get brought to the table, and then everyone has something to learn.
I want there to be a Women on the Wing chapter where I live, because we moved relatively recently and I've been trying to make friends, and y'all, it's hard working from home to meet other people, and mommy and me groups are just like, I don't know, they're not my jam, but this sounds great. This sounds like something I can get on board with.
Fun, and it's truly... with these different events, especially, and I'm going to speak to the Ladybirds again because they're here in Bismarck where I am, but we'll hold events that are just for us ladies. Then we'll hold family hiking events, and we'll hold, you know, XYZ. And so a lot of them are family friendly. Bring your spouse, bring your kids, bring your bird dog. And so it's really, I don't know, it's just really amazing. So Ashley, if you want to start one, you can email me at rtamala@pheasantsforever.org.
Duly noted. There may be one on the horizon in Nashville. I don't have like a timeline, but actually another Quail Forever employee he's working on getting a chapter off the ground here in this town. And so I'm supporting that. Maybe we can do some Women on the Wing stuff within that, like you talked about, Renee. But that actually brings up something that I've been curious about. Britta and I have talked a little bit about how hunting with other women, like hunting in a group of exclusively women, is different from, you know, the experience of being in kind of a mixed group. How would you describe I know before you used the term vibrant energy, which I thought was great, but I guess how would you describe the differences between maybe just the atmosphere of a traditional chapter, or like what's the value that an all women's chapter brings?
That's kind of a loaded question that I could spend a lot of time answering. These women's chapters and women's events, even if they're held by traditional chapters, they really foster just, safe is not the right word, but an environment that's comfortable. You're not necessarily learning from your spouse or your dad, because I think both of you can agree with me that doesn't always go that well. But really, we can have these candid conversations about what it's like to be a woman in the outdoor space, and the empowerment that comes out of that is like none other. I owe so much of who I am to my dad, but that doesn't mean that he taught me how to shoot a gun well, or didn't always know how to handle the conflicting feelings or emotions that sometimes come with being a female hunter. There was a conversation I had not that long ago with a really good friend of mine. He couldn't believe it when I told him that I still cry every single time I take a deer and how much I struggle with it. And so pulling from my own personal journey, I take great joy in embracing who I am as a hunter and an angler, and then sharing that with other women hunters, whether they're aspiring or seasoned hunters, so that hopefully they'll feel as though they're comfortable with whatever being a hunter is for them, and knowing that making mistakes along the way is just part of it, that they belong out there, and to just get out there and do it. And that's, it's just unique to women's dedicated opportunities, events, whatever it may be.
Yeah, Renee, thanks for sharing that. That was well said. From my experience with those events, I feel exactly the same way, in that it's just such a good space, and it's amazing the conversations that come up, just like you said, about in particular those feelings that come with harvesting something. And I think I've had multiple conversations with ladies at some of these events about how, yeah, sometimes it's okay if you get out there and you plan to hunt, but you actually just end up watching. And I know one lady in particular had told me afterwards, I'm so glad you said that, because I've done that before, but I never tell anyone because I don't think that that's what you're supposed to do. And so stuff like that, I think is to have that space. And I also distinctly remember one event where we talked about how to pee in the woods, and you wouldn't probably, you know, have that in a mixed group, just saying. So there's stuff like that that is also important.
Is so important, and it just lets you be more candid again about being a woman in the outdoor space, whatever that looks like to you, or whatever you want it to look like to you. But it's just like with anything, it's hindered sometimes if there's a mix in the room.
Yeah, I definitely identify with all that, and I feel like maybe community is a good word to bring to the fore here. That's what's been coming to my mind. And like, you know, everybody brings value, but to have kind of that, I don't say sacred space, that's not the right word, but a little bit, the place where you can maybe be your fullest self, your truest self, is really valuable. And I'll also say, like, I think just walking into a meeting, like if there's a chapter meeting and I'm gonna go for the first time, I don't know anybody, but it's something that I'm interested in, I saw it online, you know, like walking into a room where a lot of people look like me, or I, you know, can make the assumption that they see the world a little bit similarly to the way that I do, experience it in kind of the same way, that's a lot easier to step into than, you know, feeling like I'm the odd woman out, or like I need to prove myself, or just establish credibility, even if I have it, you know, it's not assumed, maybe. So I can see the value in that too.
I feel like sometimes women feel like they have to qualify themselves in order to say that they're a hunter or an angler or whatever it is. And there's a lot to be said about seeing yourself in the outdoor space. I just recently watched a little girl flip through the Pheasants Forever magazine, not knowing anything in particular that she was looking for, until she saw a female hunter on a page and stopped and stared at that and went, "Who is this?" And so whether you're young or old, 10, 20, 60, it's important to see yourself out there, and it can be really intimidating. And so just having these spaces where we can bring those women together and connect over conservation and habitat and hunting, it's just, I love it. I love it so much. It's one of my favorite parts of the job.
You can definitely hear that when you're talking about it. All right, I'm gonna do a hard right, maybe not too hard of a right, but I want to talk a little bit about dogs. Specifically your dog, Renee. Can you give us some background on that animal?
I can. Animal, creature, beast, you've, yes.
Divine entity, maybe not.
Quill is in a world of his own. He is a 3-year-old German wire-haired pointer. He is curled up at my feet right now, so hopefully he stays that way for the duration of this, but So as a German wire-haired pointer, of course, he's stubborn as any good German is, but he's so quirky, and there isn't a day that he doesn't make me laugh multiple times a day. And I love, love, love my time in the fields with him, especially watching someone take their first pointed bird over him. He's got more giddy up and go than I ever expected. He is my first pointing dog. I grew up on labs, so he is a lot of fun to hunt with amidst a few curse words here and there.
That's pretty, I mean, that's got to be the case for all dogs, but yeah, I can imagine. How did it feel transitioning from labs to a pointing dog? We talked a little bit about labs on the last one, and we were trying to convince Ashley that she should go with lab, but just curious.
It's intense. It's very overwhelming sometimes, and we talk about being intimidating, dipping your toes into the water of the pointing dog world when you come from flushers is a lot, because I still don't know what I'm doing, but thankfully I can take birds over him and we can work well together. But training him, I leaned heavily on my NAVDA chapter a lot here in Bismarck to train him, because I read the books and I did the prep, but once you put it all into play, it's a lot to take in, and it's been so fun, though, and so rewarding, and I do truly love a pointed bird. I do love labs, and I love flushers, but there is something just that I will never get tired of watching him go on point and being able to take a bird over him. It's one of my favorite things in this whole world, so it's very overwhelming and intimidating, but definitely encourage you to go for it if you're on the fence, and I'll give you the boot over to the other side.
That's much appreciated. We do not have a pointing dog. I've never owned one. Collectively, our family has not yet owned one, but I do think that's where we're headed next. Probably a setter, because right now we have a Springer, and earlier, Renee, when you were talking about hunting being great with a few curse words sprinkled in, I was laughing so hard that my headphones fell off, because that is our life. And I guess maybe it always will be.
What is it without a little bit of chaos? I just, you know, it's more memorable.
Definitely. Okay, so as somebody who, my upland bird hunting experiences are pretty limited just by virtue of where I live, and unfortunately bird populations here, we have to travel. I've never hunted in North Dakota. I'm curious if you could kind of give us some specifics on what that's like.
You have to come and see for yourself.
Road trip.
I'm going to hold you to
accepted.
That.
Accepted. We won't wait for the next eclipse.
Please don't. I will hold you to that, both of you. Open invitation if any ladies want to come out and hunt North Dakota. We've had really good bird numbers the past couple of years. We've been really fortunate. It's not as good as the heyday back in 2015, 16, 17-ish, but our Hungarian partridge last year were up 200%, and they're seemingly all over the state, no matter where you look. We didn't bag a single one last year, despite that. So, but we've got a good mix of pheasants, sharp-tail grouse, huns. You can really tire yourself out here on a vast array of public lands. Private Lands Open to Sportsmen is our public access program. And I'm a primarily public land hunter, and from cattails and pheasants to short grass prairie in September with grouse. I love it all. I think grouse is by far my favorite, especially those warm September, October days. Not too warm. Quill's a fair weather dog. So like 40 is his optimal operating temperature, but it's truly so fun to hunt the different regions of North Dakota for birds. I highly recommend.
Cool. Whenever I think of grouse, I think of Northwoods, and I need to paint a better picture in my mind of grouse on the prairie, because it's not what pops into my brain when people talk about that.
Yeah, we've had a group of my
lady friends that have gone out to Western North Dakota for Sharpies the last couple years, and you know, they've had a blast. So it's definitely been on my mind too to give something like that a try in that big landscape.
Yes, short grasp.
I was just going to say, isn't the terrain a little bit easier to navigate, like, compared to a cattail slough? That's another, like, for me at this point in my life, I'm like, yeah, that sounds good.
Far. Usually sharp-tailed grouse are out in short grass prairie, and so it's primarily walking, and it's easy walking because you're not really going through a whole lot of vegetation, some snowberries and things like that, but that's one of the reasons why I do love grouse hunting so much out here is because I do get to walk, and I love to cover miles, and I just love to wear myself out following Quill. And he's a big running dog, as most, you know, most pointing dogs are, and being able to see the dog work in that short grass is, no, it's amazing. I just can't even put it into words. The dog work is truly incredible, and watching the grouse carve out a life on the landscape in the short grass prairie is really, really cool.
Did you train, okay, two questions, take them in the order you like them. One, how did you settle on Quill's name, and has he earned that namesake? Two, did you train him yourself, or did you send him out, or how did that work?
I'll use the word train very loosely. We did do everything ourselves, so we're still a work in progress 3 years later, but again, relied really heavily on my NAVDA chapter, especially not knowing what I'm doing, but Quill made me work a little bit harder for it to get him to point birds, and he figured out the game pretty early on with pigeons and non-game birds, that he could just run and grab a launcher with a bird in it and run away. Uh-huh. Yep.
Too many brain cells, that one.
So smart. Makes me work for it. And there was actually one time a couple summers ago where I had him on a long check cord, and was trying to get him steady to point, to the flush, I guess is how you would say it. And so a bird was launched, a pigeon, and I was standing on the check cord to get him to stay very steady in his point. And he backed up at some point and turned and then took off at full speed. And the rope around my ankle just wiped the feet out from underneath me. Everyone got a super good laugh at it. I had some good bruises after that. So we've been, again, training very loosely. We've been through it, and it's been fun as much as it has been challenging. But he actually is named after the quill of a feather. I wanted something that represented nature, represented how much I love the outdoors, but not in a cheesy way, so to say. So most people are like, you named a German dog after a porcupine, Quill. And while he does have an affinity for porcupines, it is actually not what he's named after.
I like that. I'm like 4 weeks away, maybe two, hopefully not six, from giving birth to a boy, and we don't have a name, you guys, because this is it's hard to come up with something. And I like how you approach that, because I think you hit the nature thing, but it's not cheesy. Let's hear about the porcupine situation.
Was it his fault, or was it like a really, you know, excitable, aggressive porcupine? Whose fault was it?
I think he would appreciate your approach to that, Britta. Hunting. This one, as in there have been three that he has encountered and been quilled by, but this last one we were shed hunting, and he had not been ran for a week or two, so he was a little hot to trot, and we were about 20 yards from the truck into a shelter belt tree row, and I heard him go on point. We had just started looking for antlers, and I hit the the tone button on my handheld remote, which is his recall. So when he hears the beep, he's supposed to come back to me. But when I hit the beep, I heard a scuffle. And so he was very amped up, hadn't been run. And I think when I hit the tone button, he either got startled or it was enough encouragement to close the gap between him and a porcupine. Oh. And that one, he got a mouthful in that one. I will say, though, he does point them, and he did have this one pointed. And so if I can see the porcupine, I obviously know to call him off of it. But the first one he ever encountered and bit, I actually released him on because I was kicking around for a bird in a cattail slough, didn't see anything, nearly kicked the porcupine myself. I don't know how I didn't, which I would have been so mad about. Released him and he bit it. And then this fall, the second one ever that he got too close to it and it actually hit his nose, probably with its tail on a swipe. So not mouth on that one, but we're three down and hopefully no more to go.
Oh, that's a lot.
Yeah. To be continued.
Oh, gosh. I've never had a porcupine dog encounter, but yesterday, actually, I could see a person out our back window just, like, looking in our yard, just, like, standing in another, and it was weird. It was, like, not somebody I recognized. Like, what are they doing? And then I heard a bark, and I look out, and our dogs there was a woodchuck, a massive woodchuck inside the fence of our backyard. I know how it got in, actually, but then it couldn't get out because the way I have the fence, it's like a funnel trap, basically. Anyway, in the South, a lot of people call them whistle pigs. So it was like, I swear, a 20-pound whistle pig, which, you know, it's a rodent. It has big teeth. And for whatever, I don't know why they didn't attack it, but I'm so thankful they were just like, you know, eyeing it up, bobbing their heads from 15 feet away. And I went out there and brought him in, and I don't know where I'm going with this, except that was scary, and there were no quills involved whatsoever, so I can't imagine that. Like, what is it? Okay, what can you describe what it's like to remove a porcupine quill from inside of your dog's mouth? Because it sounds terrible no matter where, but especially that.
Not fun. Do not recommend. being prepared for it is key. And so even this trip, we were shed hunting, not hunting, but I still had the first aid kit with, because otherwise I would have been up a crick, so to say, and had to have gone to the vet somewhere. But I had my Leatherman, and I can just kind of like lock him between my knees. So I've got his head basically locked between my knees, and I start pulling. This one was back far enough on his tongue that I had to break off a stick and basically use it. I forgot the word for what that's called. But basically you put it as far back, like a bit, basically. And so it helps keep it open. He hated that. It probably made it harder. But your adrenaline kind of kicks in a little bit and just like your need to get out of the situation, basically. And he's thrashing around. He's pretty good about letting me pull them out, and not a lot of dogs are. But so far, I've been able to pull all of them on my own, except for this last bout. I had to take him in because a couple were festering in his lip, which gives him a little bit of a droopy lip, which I call the quill lip, and it's really ugly and really cute all at the same time. But he had to get that one taken out by the vet, which was unfortunate. But you just try to get out of it as fast as you can.
Do you think there's like a threshold of how many encounters he'll have before he thinks, maybe I leave this next one alone? Or is it just like, nope, this thing is, I want it?
I think if I could answer that for German dog owners everywhere and figure it out, I'd be a millionaire. But no, I don't know. Some dogs truly have an affinity for porcupines. And again, I'm lucky enough that he points them. There's actually porcupine aversion training that you can do, similar to rattlesnake. I don't know. I think he's smart and dense enough that he's just going to keep doing it until, I don't know.
Oh, man. I lately have been talking about our dog. Like, he doesn't think about things. He's just in a continuous state of reaction. And I feel like that could describe this. All right. Thank you for sharing about Quill. That was good. If you were queen for a day, or even longer, but queen for a day, what would you change to impact conservation?
I want to go so many directions with this. And also, if we could make this come to fruition, I'd be all for it.
Why not?
Do it.
I think that I would make it a requirement for every person to visit the uplands over the spring and summertime. Ideally making it so that everyone had to watch a lek, whether it's sharp-tailed grouse or prairie chickens or whichever bird, but witnessing the prairie come to life in that really stunning way to fuel an appreciation for our uplands. It wouldn't matter whether you're a hunter, non-hunter, angler, nature nerd, bird lover, camper, kayaker, runner, insert whoever, just everyone to be required to take a step into the uplands and put a name to a few native wildflowers or pollinators, just to better expose people to how diverse and important and really unique those spaces are. And then, I mean, when you think about it, we all have time, talent, and treasure. Everyone has something to give back to our natural resources, and helping us perpetuate those places that we absolutely need in our world. It's a very long-winded answer, but I think that'd be it.
I'm right there with you, girl. Fantastic answer.
That is so good. I feel like at this point, there are many more Americans that have more knowledge about savannas in Africa than about grasslands or a lot of ecosystems, really, in North America. So I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. All right. In closing, let's talk about our most recent adventure, or what's coming up for each of us. Britta, you're up first. We already heard about the eclipse. I mean, feel free to elaborate if that's how you want to take it.
It's hard to top it, but no, I would just say that was that trip was also with one of my best friends who flew from Idaho to Wisconsin, and then we drove down there. So just the old encouragement for everyone out there to get out and see something new is all I would say, because it was thrilling and exciting and reminded me that it's good to take vacation once in a while and go see something cool.
Yeah, definitely. Renee, what about you? Do you need more time, or do you have your adventure at the ready?
I think it's really hard to pick just one to be excited about, but turkey season is upon us. It starts this weekend, the Saturday, in North Dakota. I've got a tag for the Badlands out west and one more centrally. Hopefully get a tag over in Minnesota as well, but foraging for ramps and morels is coming up quickly. Spring bass fishing, which will roll into muskie fishing. The wood ducks are officially back, so gluing my eyes to the wood duck boxes. Dog training, I don't know. It's hard to pick just one, so all of the above?
Yeah, all the seasonal stuff. I'm there. Our turkey season opens in 2 days. And I don't know, you guys. I'm not like a serious turkey hunter anyway. My husband's like, do you want to go next week? Like the two of us, which is like, you know, a date, which we don't do anymore. And I'm like, yes, I want to go turkey hunting. So if it happens, it'll be in a spot that he scouted. He's going to call for me. I'm just going to sit down, hopefully not too far from the truck, and whatever happens, happens. But we did get out as a family foraging. We were looking for morels. Didn't find any on that excursion, but it was really fun to be out there. And I collected some bed straw and fiddleheads. I don't know. I don't know what it's called in the Midwest. Bedstraw, gallium. There's another word for it too that I'm not going to remember. Anyway, brought that home. I bent my huge pregnant self bent over so many times to pick so many of those stems to make it worth cooking something, and put it in the fridge. And then I Googled it quickly, and it was like Native Americans use this plant to prevent pregnancy. May induce uterine contractions. Do not eat if you're pregnant.
Oh my God.
Glad I Googled that. So I didn't eat it. But, yeah.
Foraging is like the biggest learning curve. Last year, my parents and I did fiddleheads and fried them all up, ate them, and then spent a little time on Google, and the species that we had picked was filthy with carcinogens and like things that you don't want to be eating. And so I don't know. Foraging is intense.
It's a thing. Yep. It's a thing. And I love to, like, every foraging book that I have, you know, it lays out, like, this is what it looks like. This is where you can find it. This is how you can prepare it. And then at the bottom, it's like, be certain of your identification. Don't only rely on these things that I've outlined. I'm like, yeah, I don't know. Luckily, most things are not going to kill you. They can make you sick, but most of the time, most stuff isn't going to end in a lethal episode. But it's also like then when you bring kids into the mix, it's like, we got to be really sure what we're doing here. Anyway, Renee, thank you so much for being on with us and for having this conversation and sharing your experience with us. It's been really wonderful.
Absolutely. Likewise. Love chatting with you girls. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. Join us next month, I believe, for another conversation with the women of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. And if you want to support the creation of Upland Bird Habitat, become a member at pheasantsforever.org or quailforever.org.